Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the second week of June. This week, we are very pleased to have for you part two of our fascinating conversation with Dr. Jeff Hammerson about bird migration, which we recorded last month. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. I'll forewarn you that this is a tricky one, something that most of you will have heard, but not recognized for what it is, as I didn't myself until a month or so ago. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. One of the most exciting things for me over the past couple of weeks was finding a downy woodpecker nest in my woods. I was working outdoors at my house when I started hearing this sound that I can best describe as purring crickets. Finally tracking it down to this scrawny willow snag, barely 8 inches in circumference. I sat down to scan the area with my binoculars and was finally rewarded with the sight of a downy woodpecker popping into a well-hidden cavity, feeding what sounded like 3 to 4 hungry nestlings inside.
Downy woodpeckers are the smallest of our Washington state woodpeckers. They look almost identical to a hairy woodpecker, which are also common in our area. But the hairies are about 3 inches longer with a much longer, stouter bill proportional to their heads. You can tell the male from the female in both species by the male's spot of red on the back of the head. And both male and female incubate the eggs and feed the young.
The young are sounding considerably more strident now than when I first heard them. An almost constant yammering to be fed during daylight hours now. And they should be leaving the nest soon. One of the most remarkable things about finding this nest was recognizing, once again, the value of snags in our landscape as wildlife habitat. This tree is not anything that you would look at twice. It's small in diameter, doesn't have any salient features, but yet it's home to this woodpecker family, and who knows what else. Leaving dead trees standing and on the ground if they fall down is one of the most important things that we can do to provide sanctuary for wildlife. And now, on to part two of our interview with Jeff Hammerson about the wonders of bird migration. So, what's the latest thinking on how birds find their way? I mean, is it by the stars, magnetic fields? Is it something that's genetically programmed or something that they learn from others?
All right, well, let's start with an easy example to
Let's do that.
Since it gets really complicated quickly when we ask how birds do this. How do they find their way? Think of geese, for example. Geese find the way. Young geese, how do they know where to go? They follow their parents. That's simple as that. They have a instinctive urge to follow their parents. And so they do. They stick with their parents through that migration southward. And they learn the way, and they remember it.
Can you imagine that? Can you imagine learning the way, I mean, that far with just one take?
Yeah, one take, yeah. That's all it takes. But then let's compare that to something like Western sandpiper. It's the most abundant shorebird on our Pacific coast here. They nest most of them up in Western Alaska. All right, so the parents are done nesting. And then they take off, they leave. And the juveniles that have just been raised stay around for a while, feeding some more, but they're left, they're abandoned. Mom and dad take off and head south a month before the juveniles do. And then the juveniles make their first migration, no parental guidance at all.
Wow.
They find their way to an appropriate habitat. Well, how do they do that? Well, they have instinctive, genetically programmed responses to cues that are available to them. For example, which way to go? They know which way to go just inherently. It's programmed into their genetic makeup. So they know in the fall they're going to go south. And how do they know which way is south? Well, they have an instinctive response to compass cues or directional cues that are out there, like the sun. We can use that as a compass, so can birds. The night sky, the stars in the sky, for example, we can use that as a directional compass, and so can birds. And something that we can't use so readily, just without help, without devices, is the Earth's magnetic field. And birds can sense that. And they actually have in their eyes molecules that are sensitive to geomagnetism.
You were describing that to me, and I didn't realize that. That's just so amazing. Like from the air, we see topographic lines, but they see it in magnetic fields.
Yeah, it gets complicated really fast as to exactly how they're perceiving it, but it apparently functions as a visual cue, the Earth's magnetic field, so that we look over the landscape and see a topography, and so do birds. They actually use those mountain ranges and rivers and coastlines to help them on their migrations, but also they can perceive the Earth's magnetic field, and they can perceive it as a map, not only directionally, so they can tell which way is north and south, and they respond instinctively with seasons as to which way to go. But also, once they make a migration, they're following this topography, this magnetic, geomagnetic topography as well, and learning it and using it for their later migrations as a map, because they remember all this. This is the weird thing is that they do it once and they, oh, okay, I got it. And they can go back.
You're just about to tell me some amazing stories of how they go back to the exact same place, right?
Yeah, it's not a very generalized kind of navigation system. It's very specific. In fact, most of the birds that make long-distance migrations end up going to, in subsequent years, the same places they were the previous year, whether it be to spend the winter. It might be the same beach in Panama, or the same shoreline in Peru, or the same island in Chile, and the same beach on the same island in Chile.
Wow.
And then they'll end up back, let's say, in a nesting area in Alaska or somewhere far in the far north that is just the same place where they were the year before. In fact, some of the tracking devices that people use nowadays to find out where birds are going are so tiny, you can put them on small birds. Mm-hmm. That's the advantage. But they don't transmit information. We do have satellite tracking devices, and those are used, and they're very informative. But for tiny, tiny birds, they're just too big. And so a little Western sandpiper needs a small tracking unit. And in order to get the information from that tracking unit, you have to catch the bird, put the unit on its leg, then it goes on migration, and then you have to catch it again.
That's right.
The next year, after it's returned to a nesting area, let's say in Alaska, you put your mist net, your capturing devices out, you catch the bird in the same place you caught it the year before, because they go back there, and not all of them, but many, many, in fact, most, the vast majority. And then you can remove this tiny device and extract the information and learn where it went during that past year or even longer.
Wow. It's just remarkable. So most birds are nocturnal migrants, right?
Yeah. If you consider the songbirds around here, pretty much all of them except for, let's say, swallows or a few others migrate at night. The typical thing is they take off after sunset and fly most of the night, and then they come down. The advantage to that is that they can spend the daylight hours feeding.
Uh-huh.
If you're a warbler and you're migrating hundreds of miles each night, you've got to feed. And so
they can also avoid predators.
And the air is more stable at night.
Uh-huh.
There's cues there for them to follow, of course. The stars are there, so they don't have any trouble figuring out which way to go. If you're a soaring bird, though, and you make use of updrafted winds off of a mountain or thermally driven air masses, hot air rising off of a big field, for example, warm air rises, and they use those like hawks and Sandhill cranes will use those. Those birds that need those updrafts migrate during the daytime.
Uh-huh.
But if you just counted up the number of species that day versus night, it'd be mostly nighttime migration.
And especially like the songbirds, the smaller mm-hmm. birds are mostly. And a really cool thing to do is to actually set up a scope so that you can watch them cross
yeah.
the moon, right?
Yeah, you can actually see them. When I heard about this, I said, I got to try it.
Yeah.
And I got my scope out, 20 power scope, aimed it at the moon, full moon during the migration season. And like within 30 seconds, I was seeing birds. I was like, holy cow. And you could
see. It's like this hidden world. You just had no idea.
You can sometimes make out what type of bird it is. Maybe not exactly, but well, that looks like a shorebird, or that looks like something else, and tell which direction they're going. Yeah. There are a lot of water birds that migrate day or night. So there's some that are very flexible and go either way too.
So how do birds prepare for their journey, and what usually triggers their departure?
All right, so let's consider a bird that's a long distance migrant. So it's not just flying, you know, from here to Whidbey Island, but it's flying hundreds, if not thousands of miles on a leg of its migration. That requires fuel, of course, and the fuel is fat. And so the primary thing that the migrant has to do before it can take off and leave is fatten up. And we're talking about major fattening up. And this is, it ranges in different species, but commonly 1/3 to 1/2 of that bird's body weight will be fat.
That's just astonishing. I mean, it's like us putting on an extra 50 pounds or more.
Or more, yeah. Yeah, and the odd thing is that these obese birds are super athletes that aren't encumbered by this, but are actually facilitated by having this big fuel supply that they can use. So they eat a lot of food, they select fat-rich foods, and then once they've hit this 30 to 40 to 50% fat level, then they wait for the winds. Because winds are important.
But back to food, you were telling me a really cool thing about them eating biofilm, which I had no idea about. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so right now, actually, this is where it was discovered, and it's happening in other places, but we'll use the discovery point up on the Fraser River Delta up in Vancouver, BC, not far from here, go north in the Salish Sea. Big mud flats there, and the sandpipers there, western sandpipers and dunlins, lots of sandpipers migrate through there and use those mud flats. And we always assumed they were just eating worms and little crustaceans and little mollusks and things like that. But it turns out that up to half their calories and their food intake up there is this mixture of goop called biofilm that thrives on the tops of these mud flats, and it's bacteria and protozoa, diatoms, little tiny algae, and it just looks like a kind of a greenish frosting. And they have a tongue that has little fringes on it, the sandpipers do,
uh-huh.
and it helps them lap up this biofilm. And it's an important source of food for them. It's actually high in energy and in omega-3 fatty acids, which are perfect for putting on fat appropriate for fueling a migration. So we're just learning about that, really, and it probably is more widespread than we realize. So that's one of the sources of food for fattening.
Yeah,
for the migration.
That's remarkable. So, sorry, I interrupted you. You were telling me that they're triggered by that the wind often triggers their departure.
Yeah, think about it. You know, you're starting out on a flight and you're 50%, 40, 50% fat. You know, it's just makes sense that you're not going to want to fly into a headwind. You know, you're just like all good sailors and pilots, you pay attention to the weather, and the birds do, and they wait for the appropriate wind direction to come up, and then they go. In some places, there's a lagoon in Alaska, on the Alaska Peninsula, where Brant, a little goose that we have that visits Port Townsend every year, during their southward migration from their nesting areas in the Arctic, they assemble in this lagoon and fatten up, and they wait there several weeks, fattening up, but then they wait for the winds to be right. And in some of the best days up there, 100,000 of these brant, the small goose, will leave on that one day because the weather is right, and off they go.
Uh-huh.
And they're flying.
Like a sailing race.
Yeah, yeah. It's R2AK reversed. R2PT or BC, yeah. Baja California.
Yeah.
And some of them fly for 3 days nonstop, 3,000 miles to Baja.
Wow.
Others fly not quite that far. They come here to the Salish Sea.
Well, and you have some really interesting stories about seeing banded brants, right?
Yeah, yeah. Out at Point Hudson, they spend a lot of time. They're really easily accessible place. And you can sometimes see the banded brant. And I've been photographing those over several years. And I've found, I think, 32 different individuals now. And some of them I've seen in multiple years. They just come back to the same spot each year and use it as a fattening area before they migrate. And one bird in particular, I was sad to learn it died a couple years ago, only about a week after I last saw it alive and well. Mm-hmm. But I'd seen that bird 4 different times. And this is just sort of chance encounters. Uh-huh. I don't spend all my days sitting out there watching them. But that bird had just passed its 25th birthday the last time I saw it. And it was coming from Banks Island, which is Arctic Canada. And by the way brant fly, I calculated that if it spent the winter every year in the Salish Sea, and maybe some years it went to Baja, I'm not sure, but if it just went even just this far, it probably flew over 200,000 miles in its life.
That is just astonishing. How do they do it? Just amazing. We've got some really cool places where we can see large concentrations of migrants, right? I mean, one of them is Grays Harbor, and hopefully some of our radio listeners were able to get out to the festival. It's usually about the first weekend in May. They put on this shorebird festival that has lots of events and lectures you can go see. I mean, there are up to 500,000 birds that end up there, right?
Yeah, yeah. The western sandpipers and dunlins and many, many other species, but those are the two most numerous ones, pass up the coast here in April and May. And Grays Harbor, Willapa Bay, the Fraser River Delta is a good place to go to see those migrating birds. The place where the biofilm was discovered is the important food source. But then for the snow geese, in the wintering season, and they've pretty much have left now, but over in the Skagit and some of the other river deltas on the east side of the Salish Sea is where these snow geese gather, and they're very easily seen. Those snow geese that you see over there have come from, almost all of them have come from Wrangel Island off northeastern Siberia. That's where they nest.
Well,
but they come here to spend the winter in the Salish Sea coast at these river delta mouths. So it's a pretty remarkable place to see a lot of birds.
It looks like we have run out of time once again. We're going to have you back for part 3 of migration. Thanks so much for coming. And you have a book coming out. It's almost ready for press, right?
Well, it's a book on waterbird migration that I'm working on with my co-authors, Audrey Benedict, who was involved with the Salish Sea book.
And that's a beautiful book for those of you that haven't seen that. It's has gorgeous photos and lots of interesting text.
Yeah, and the book, the waterbird migration book, will look a lot like that. That's the intent of the publisher, to have it look like that. And then another biologist, Rob Butler, who's a shorebird specialist up in British Columbia, is our other co-author. But it's in the editing process now, and we're looking forward to having that come out next spring.
Great. Well, we can hardly wait to see it. So thanks so much for coming to share with
us. Well, thank you. I enjoyed being here with you.
And there are some great upcoming natural history events to tell you about this week.
The Olympic chapter of the Washington Native Plant Society has a couple of fine events planned this week. The first, a hike up to the Tubal Cane Mine and Buckhorn Pass area this Friday, June 15th. And the second, a tour of the Scow Bay Salmon Restoration Project planned for the bridge area between Indian and Maristone Islands next year. This second field trip will take place on Monday, June 17th. Go to WNPS.org and search for the Olympic Peninsula chapter for more details.
Admiralty Audubon is planning a field trip to Anderson Lake State Park this coming Saturday morning, June 15th, to look for migrating warblers and more. Meet at the parking area near the comfort stations at 9:30 a.m. or go to AdmiraltyAudubon.org for more information.
The Port Townsend Marine Science Center has a couple of grand events happening, too. First, on Saturday, June 15th, join them for the annual family-friendly celebration of orca and salmon in our Salish Sea, starting at 11 a.m. and running until 3 p.m. Then on Sunday, grab your favorite dad for Father's Day and head down to the beach for a guided low-tide walk from 9:30 to 11:30. Meet at the museum exhibit portico entrance or go to ptmc.org for additional details.
And if you missed Bob Boglehyde's great presentation on the seabirds and marine mammals of the Protection Island Aquatic Reserve a couple of months ago here in Port Townsend, this is your chance to hear it again. Bob will be speaking at the monthly program for the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, June 19th, at the Dungeness River Audubon Center just outside of Squim. For more information, please go to olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org. And here's our mystery sound again. Most of you will have an easier time identifying the following call. This call is one of the first that birders learn in North America, the lovely ringing song of the American robin. The song that we played for you as mystery sound is an alarm call, sometimes described as a dog whistle, which is most often used to alert other birds to an aerial predator, such as a hawk. Robins make about 7 distinct calls that we humans can distinguish, which have different meanings. Doubtless there are countless other calls that we could distinguish if only we were robins. It is important to try to learn not only what species of bird is calling, but what it is trying to say with its call. Our thanks to the site journeynorth.org for the beautiful recordings. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the second week of June. Thanks very much for joining me, Nora, and thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. Closing music is Arrival of the Birds by Johan Johansson. As always, happy trails!